Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, depending on where you're joining us from, and welcome to today's webinar, Enterprise Risk Management Volume 2, Effectively Communicating Risks from the Shop Floor to the Boardroom. My name's Amy. I'm a member of the marketing team at Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety, Inc., and I'll be facilitating today's webinar and offering technical support to our speakers. But today we are happy to be welcoming back a couple of familiar faces, Melanie Newman and Neil Marshall, to discuss today's topic, and we'll be introducing them to you all shortly. But now I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first speaker today, our moderator, as it were. That's Paul DeMarin. He is the Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Supply Chain here at PJRFSI. Paul joined us in January of last year and has over 35 years of experience in the hospitality, service, and retail agri-food sectors. Paul is a board member of the OFPA, that's the Ontario Food Protection Association, and he's also an advisory council member with the George Washington University School of Business for their digital marketing certificate program. And before he came to PJRFSI, Paul worked for 17 years in the certification industry with clients in every sector from food safety and supply chain to brand protection and quality. Paul's also worked for many years in management systems certification. And prior to that, Paul was a professional chef and a consultant for over 20 years. So Paul, I'll hand things over to you and you can take it away when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Amy. I really appreciate that introduction and I'd like to welcome everybody to the webinar today. We really appreciate your time, and I'm extremely excited and happy to introduce two colleagues of mine, industry colleagues, Melanie Newman and Neil Marshall, who I've known for many years and are really experts in our industry. They're certainly recognized not only by myself, but also their peers as being thought leaders in the industry and some of the top food safety minds today. So with that, let's jump right in, and I'd like to introduce you to our speakers. So first, Melanie Newman is the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for Matrix Sciences International, Inc. And they are a dynamic, multidisciplinary group of food safety and quality experts and really focus their time on microbiological, chemistry, analytical, residue, and pesticide laboratory testing, sensory testing, data analytics, and food safety risk management advisory services. Melanie assists the food and beverage industry with regulatory, operational, and brand reputation risk management solutions. And that helps companies mitigate risks in the ever-changing regulatory landscape. Melanie also interacts with regulators, customers, media, and plaintiff attorneys in response to investigations, enforcement actions, outbreaks, recalls, and alleged illness claims on behalf of her clients to resolve issues and identify appropriate corrective actions. Melanie is a magna cum laude graduate of the Mitchell Harmline Law School in St. Paul, Minneapolis for her Juris Doctorate degree and Michigan State University for her MS in Food Safety. In her spare time, Mel competes in the Ironman long distance triathlons, competing and completing her 8th Ironman triathlon in November 2019. What a pleasure, Melanie. And now let's jump over to Neil Marshall. Neil Marshall is the Managing Director at Gov Consulting International, LLC, and he works and selects global clients in the food and beverage sector. At the end of 2020, Neil retired from his role as the Global Director of Quality and Food Safety at the Coca-Cola Company after 21 years. He's also a Senior Advisor for Matrix Sciences International and works quite closely with Mel. Neil has a Master of Science degree from Sheffield Hallam University in the UK. And during his time with Coca-Cola, he held a variety of technical and supply chain roles, which started in 1999. In 2009, Neil relocated to Atlanta for the global leadership role, and he led the introduction of GFSI compliance across the 1,000 plants and over 5,000 suppliers. Neil's gained critical experience in crisis management, mergers and acquisitions, risk assessments, supplier management, technical governance, and public-private partnerships. During his career, he also worked in over 80 countries and on every continent, acting as the global technical lead for the 2008 Beijing Olympics, the 2010 South Africa World Cup, and the 2012 London Olympics. Neil has been a long-serving member of the GFSI board and president of the S-Safe, engaging externally in many conferences and industry forums with governments and regulators. So what an honor to have you both here today. We certainly thank you very, very much for joining us. And now that we've got the formalities out of the way, we're going to jump right into discussing the importance of enterprise risk management. Today, we're going to dig into what it is, how to develop a strong ERM program, and then how to effectively communicate those risks across your business. I'm going to be driving some of the questions today throughout the session. And if I've missed anything, Neil or Mel, please do step in and elaborate. And I know Mel and Neil have created an ERM model that they use every day to emphasize the key elements that should be considered for any ERM framework. So we're going to move forward to that slide now and keep that up for the balance of the presentation. Okay, so let's get started and jump right in. Mel and Neil, I know both of you speak on the topic of ERM a lot, and that's certainly great and in fact very important in today's environment. But Melanie, could you please just, you know, remind the audience what enterprise risk management is?
Sure, happy to, and thanks for the opportunity to be asked back, Paul. Always a good day when you're not one and done on these kinds of endeavors. So I dodged that enterprise risk, I guess. But no, it's great to start with the building blocks and the foundation of let's just remember what this thing is we're talking about so we have a better shot of comparing it and leveraging it to benefit our food safety programs enterprise-wide. ERM, for short, it's a framework. It's a process to be able to identify all the varied risks that are going on in an organization in a way that helps all of those stakeholders in an enterprise understand that risk is relative, right? There's a lot of risks that are flying around every day that companies are asked to manage well beyond food safety, even if our primary charge is to produce food. There's other types of risk as well. So this really gives a framework and a process to identify risk, to be able to understand what the likelihood and the impact of that risk is, manage it appropriately to your own organization's comfort level, which we often refer to as a risk appetite or risk tolerance. And then throughout time, provide that reasonable assurance or that ongoing verification that that risk is being appropriately managed and mitigated so that ultimately the enterprise doesn't have a material balance sheet risk. That's what enterprise risks are. It's those kinds of risks or threats that could literally shut down an organization. It's a material balance sheet risk. And it's also a risk that requires food safety professionals, at least in my opinion, to take on and adopt a little bit of a different vocabulary. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, where we have to understand that we speak in very comfortable terms of hazard, but a lot of our other senior leadership and our organizations speak in terms of risk and how we can translate hazard to risk in part is kind of that recipe for success in leveraging food safety and in getting an equal voice and an equal seat at the table to be able to basically compete against the other enterprise risks. So ultimately, it's a framework, it's a process to be able to resource allocate and invest your time, talent, and treasure where the risk is the most significant and could cause the biggest harm.
Okay, thank you. I love the fact that you're framing it around an actual framework, which I think is quite important. And I love your model here on the slide. So hopefully you guys are going to talk a little bit more about that as well. Neil, can you maybe just follow up on that a little bit and explain how you think an ERM could help food safety achieve visibility in the boardroom?
Sure. Yeah. Good afternoon, Paul and everybody else on the call. I think Mel captured it very well with a description there. I think one other point, I guess the whole point of an enterprise risk management is supposed to be enterprise. So across the whole organization, no matter how big or small your company or collection of companies are, it's to give the whole assessment of risks. gathered together into an overall enterprise assessment. But obviously the specific piece we're trying to focus on is around the technical risks and how to elevate and connect those into the overall risk assessment. I think we'll come on to it as well from the discussion that there's often competing pressures to gain dollars and investment and time and resources to mitigate some of those risks. But I think what both myself and Mel have seen from our careers is a need to identify those risks, categorize those risks, and then connect them from the bottom of the organization, bottom as in shop floor operational area, to the boardroom. So it's how you can simplify that, categorize it, and fight for the time and the evidence, both from a financial, reputational, you know, product mix. It could be multiple countries. It could be a historical acceptance of risk. But it's understanding what that, as Mel said, the risk vocabulary is, so that everybody's talking the same language. And then as an equal discussion and debate about how those risks are treated and mitigated, because you can't always get rid of those risks. You can only mitigate it so far. So the whole, I mean, the real push we're trying to say is you need to have a model. You need to understand the language and categorize it. And then you need to be able to deal with it and face it, because there's lots of benefits from everybody being on the same wavelength and understanding around those risks. But ERM to us is that, and I'm glad you pointed out the model, because it's something that we're trying to use as a framework for people to understand those risks.
Yeah, it's a great model, and I really do hope that we can maybe just take some time maybe towards the end and go through that in a little bit more detail. So just a follow-up question for you then, Mel, on this is, and you kind of touched briefly on in your opening statement, but if you're a new manager in today's world, or a director or a VP coming into an organization, how does somebody like that determine what the overall risk appetite for the organization is? Because, you know, maybe their understanding of what it is maybe different than the actual. And I just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
It's a really great question. And I've got some friends in the industry, Neil, I know you do too, that are shifting careers, shifting positions within the food safety space and arena, if you will. And, you know, they have a lot of questions and there's a little bit of trepidation because you don't know what kind of risk appetite you're walking into. Just like you've got to gauge corporate culture, generally speaking, and then also food safety culture, just really trying to get your hold on what the risk appetite is, is, I think, important to do in the interview process. I encourage folks to ask questions. My phrase is, be a five-year-old. Keep asking whys. You know, the root cause analysis, the five whys, ask 50 whys if you need to ask 50 whys to get there. But it is, you know, it's, hey, we produce food. Where, you know, how is food safety considered within your enterprise risk management process? If they look at you a deer in the headlights, A, they don't have an ERM process. And B, my guess is they probably aren't significantly investing in food safety to the degree you probably want them to, because you asked that question, right? I think number two, asking that question really sets you apart in the interview process. Mm-hmm. But I think number three, and most importantly, is, you know, you'll at least understand what to expect, right? Where are we on the maturity model of food safety culture at minimum? It's going to speak a lot to corporate culture as well, but really understanding what is the process, how is food safety assessed and evaluated within the ERM process? Is this a once a year process behind closed doors with the COO, the CFO, and the CEO with no other input whatsoever, which we see a lot of?
Yeah.
Great. At least it's being done. Don't get me wrong, right? But where are the various other inputs coming from so that you have an equal voice and an equal footing, and you're jumping into the ring with the same size boxing gloves on everyone else's you're competing with? Because if you go into that fight blind, chances are you're the one who's going to get left with the lint lined pockets and maybe not as much resources as you need. And as you perhaps could have set yourself up for, if you ask these kinds of questions, even as early as the interview phase of walking into a new organization. I don't know if that answers your question, Paul, but I think that it's really ask a lot of questions and don't wait to be invited to the party. Yeah. Write your own invite, pull your own seat up to the table and start at least offering, volunteering the information that the others need to perform that ERM assessment meaningfully with respect to food safety. What data do you need? What information are you looking at when you are evaluating these risks relative to other risks in the enterprise? Because again, going back to risk is relative, we're not going to have zero risk in almost any category. Our doors will close. How much risk are we willing to accept? But understanding where they're getting the information from and how you can help influence and better educate that team that is doing the ERM process. Fabulous. Best yet, invite yourself to actually participate in it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's amazing. And this is getting exciting already. We're talking about interview skills. We're talking about corporate and food safety culture. And we're only 18 minutes in. I love it. Okay, so just before I go to the next question, Neil, did you have anything you wanted to add to Mel's?
I'll just add a little bit to the risk appetite point. I think, you know, as you mentioned in the intro, my career with Coke, which is basically a very risk averse company. But risk averse because there's a lot to protect, a lot of brands to protect, and a lot of history to protect. And of course, being a big brand owner, multiple billion dollars in brand revenue and worth, then people are always trying to attack those companies. But also in the flip side to that, in the last 6 months since I left Coke and been doing consulting, I've come across a lot of different companies with a lot of different approaches as well. So you can see from the huge multinational, there's a lot to protect and a lot of structure and process around ERM and risk management and mitigation. And then you talk to a lot of the other companies who have not as, you know, well-developed processes, or in some cases as well-developed, but a different perception of what that risk is and what that risk is to their business. And how much they're prepared to accept. I think that's something to think about when you're talking about the appetite. So you can't tell, I don't think, from when you just look at a company and meet the people. You need a much better in-depth, you know, dig into the organization to understand what they are prepared to accept as that risk level.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point. And actually further on that then, Mel, what do you find are some of the main risks, I guess, that organizations typically target for their ERM programs? And in your opinion, do you think any of them are more important than others?
Oh, well, you're asking a lawyer a question. And so that second part of that question, I might just plead the fifth on, but there is a lot of very important risks to an enterprise. I think in any industry, we often will see cybersecurity or IT infrastructure protection as one of, if not the leading enterprise risk year after year. The more reliant any company is on technology, the more at risk we are. From, you know, hacks, ransomware, you know, breaches, data breaches, things of that nature. And so understandably so, that group and in your, you know, the food safety professionals peer in IT, you two are going to be, you know, kind of boxing out for a finite number of pennies in that piggy bank, right? It's very important. We might not be able to ensure food safety if there's a cybersecurity breach, if we lose power, if we lose temperature control. Think, you know, the dependencies of some of these enterprise risks, I think we can do a better job, even in our roles in food safety, to communicate those dependencies is that, well, you know, kind of if you can't beat them, join them. It's like, well, let me tag on to, you know, the cybersecurity request, because a part of that can actually maybe resource our, you know, continuous temperature control monitoring needs that we're asking for versus taking manual temperatures once an hour where people can forget, things of that nature. I think that, you know, other kinds of of enterprise risks we often see are commodity prices, currency exchange rates, labor and union organizational issues, people safety. COVID really brought that to light. We had a lot of the same people who were historically charged with looking out for food safety all of a sudden asked to be also looking out for COVID compliance, the people safety side of things, right? And again, you know, wearing those multiple hats and competing for limited funds, risk, again, going back to that phrase, if no one hears anything else I say, is risk is relative and it's ever changing. And so sometimes these in companies with the best of intentions who've got really well-structured enterprise risk management processes, you do it once a year and a global pandemic hits a month after you just did it, maybe you need to go back to the well and reconsider and reevaluate where your biggest enterprise risks are when you have a material change in the risk landscape. So I think ultimately those are, you know, just some examples. I mean, just competition, right? You know, the need for sales and marketing innovation and dollars to roll out the next new product to keep up with, you know, your next biggest market competition is a risk to the overall health and the, you know, material balance sheet risk to your organization, in addition to food safety. And so I don't know that so much of it is, you know, one's more significant than the other. I mean, I think, again, it's very much a let's identify all the risks. Let's understand the likelihood and the impact of these risks happening. How can we reasonably mitigate these risks to acceptable levels that fit within our comfort or our risk appetite or risk tolerance in our organization? And then how do we make sure that we monitor that over time and we measure that over time? Going back to some of these entries in the model here, monitoring and measuring that your risk mitigation strategy for an enterprise risk is really important. You know, it's just like putting in a preventive control for a hazard that requires one under FSMA's preventive controls rules, right? It's right. How do we know it's actually working? And I think Neil might speak to that a little bit more because we're very passionate about putting some kind of metric or some kind of monitoring program in place to say, hey, the more we try to tie and integrate food safety with enterprise risk management principles and thinking, how do we know if it's working? Right? How do we know other than we got more funding this year than we did last year, or we actually got a capital request approved versus, you know, in years past, we typically get met with, met with denial, those kinds of things.
Right.
Sorry, Paul, there's a couple of things that just struck me again, listening to Mel and you talk there as well, particularly about the last point. And it's really to make sure you have, and it's on the chart there as well, a cross-functional team. So we're not, just to be clear as well, we're not talking just about the technical food safety people being part of the ERM. This is all multi-functions, you know, marketing, communications, general management, legal, finance, everybody needs to be part of the overall ERM. And the technical risks that we would identify, you know, from our normal working scope, would be things around supplier issues, audit results, consumer complaints, customer complaints, pathogen monitoring programs, environmental monitoring, all the results you would have that would then define what are your biggest risks that you may or may not have a mitigation in place. But then you would be rolling that up to say, for the overall enterprise or for the 20 sites or 5 sites or whatever we have from a technical perspective, these are the risks that roll to the top in the overall company ERM that are important. And that's where Mel's mentioning about the fight for the dollars and the information for future investment. But I'm just trying to make it, you know, granular and clear so we're not just talking over the top of it. But I think really that whole piece about everyone's then fighting for their risks to be identified. But what we've often seen from experiences, those, I call it shop floor or operational issues, don't connect to the top. And what's perceived as the C-suite or the CEO or whoever at the top don't necessarily connect the two together. it's not necessarily they don't understand what the risks are, but they are then competing on X million for a new line or a new factory or warehouse or whatever it is, or new fleet. So there's competing information and for resources, but really making this ERM effective means that you've got to get back to the skills again for the people, the technical people, the QA and the food safety people, is to make sure that they can talk the right language and explain those risks up through the organization so it hits the right level. And you know, let's be clear as well, so that some of the senior managers don't feel stupid and actually do understand what the risks are and do understand by not investing in that pathogen monitoring or the testing or the external labs or whatever it is, that there is a real risk there that left unresolved can cause the whole company to collapse very quickly. And we mentioned COVID. That's where COVID and the shift in everybody's focus around, you know, monitoring contractors, not letting auditors on site, you know, all the extra checks that were put in place, as Mel said, got pushed to the technical groups again. So I think, you know, cross-functional teams, and a big one, I was just finding a long-winded way to get around to saying, is around training and practicing. You know, you got to train and practice for these routines in order to connect it in properly to your ERM program. It should become second nature that you know how to manage crisis and incidents, and then you correctly categorize what they are. Because practice, practice, practice means you're prepared. Everybody has an issue every day in a manufacturing. There's always something.
If I can, I'm just going to give you a super quick example. So, and this has happened more than once to me, working with a company to help them integrate their food safety metrics, quality management programs to enterprise risk management. The top food safety professional in that organization is like, here you go, here's all my great metrics. And they are, they're fabulous. They're the metrics you would typically, you know, expect to see about first time right and sanitation effectiveness and, you know, all these kinds of things, right? And it gives them a lot of really good actionable information. And then I asked, does your company have an ERM program? And they say, well, yes, but we're not a part of it. So a month and a half later, takes a month and a half to get the information to actually, instead of just getting the word, yes, we do enterprise risk management once a year, to get the output, to get the actual deliverable, like, well, what is it? Where does food safety rank on it? And what within that food safety? Great, food safety is number 4 out of 5. Woohoo, it's on there. That's saying something. Let's peel back that onion a little more. Okay, well, what does food safety mean to that group of people? You know, if it was that closed door CFO, CEO, COO, great. But what about that food safety enterprise risk got their attention, right? What do they think they're monitoring and mitigating and measuring? What do they think that they're reducing the risk to the enterprise for? Turns out there were 7 things, only 3 of which the head of food safety was monitoring from the bottom up. So the top down had a different list. Mm-hmm. And there's like a third deliverable. There's like a third thing that needs to be put in place to close that gap. I know that sounds kind of confusing, but time and time again, we're seeing that there's a literal delta the size of the Grand Canyon we can't jump across unless we are a 5-year-old and keep asking why questions and keep asking show me the ERM process and show me what's entailed in it, because I want to make sure we as an organization don't have a disconnect and we're looking at the same risks, measuring, mitigating them, monitoring them, communicating about them, and effectuating the change in the right direction that we all want to go. And that we're, again, going back to, we're speaking the same language, that you're not speaking Greek and I'm not trying to speak Chinese, and there's going to be a translation issue in the middle.
I think it's great. I mean, everything you guys are talking about is music to my ears. You know, I hear corporate, I hear food safety culture, cybersecurity, and it leads me back to the standards that have been integrated for many, many years, like quality, environmental health, and safety. And over the last 5 years or so, we've really started to see a big push for the integration of not only food safety standards with quality, but also other standards like cybersecurity and enterprise risk management as well. I mean, right now I'm overseeing our cybersecurity group here at PJR as well. And part of that group is a new set of standards that have come into play known as the CMMC, which is the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification. And these are the standards that are mandated by the DoD, Department of Defense, against all of their contractors in the defense industrial base, which is about 300,000 of them. So I just love the way that you both put this together and really kind of tied it together in the picture. So thank you very much for that. Neil, I think a lot of companies today are probably doing this a little differently, but in your opinion, at the enterprise level, how often did you conduct risk assessments or enterprise risk assessments? And, you know, what would you recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, I guess over the last 10 years, it's varied quite a lot, Paul, but towards the latter, we were doing it as a minimum twice a year, but then also monitoring every quarter. So I would say, you know, best practice would be to do it every quarter. But in reality, how often do some of these risks change, and how clearly or quickly are they being mitigated? So I think you need to do it at least twice a year, you know, mid-year and the end of the year. It needs to be built into a routine. And part of, especially on bigger organizations such as Coke, you know, there's so many entities and connections that are connected up. It's difficult to do it without doing that on a frequent basis. But whenever it's done, it needs to be connected to all the other functions. And you need to be able to, you know, do the technical risk assessment for the technical risks. You need a standard format. There need to be standard definitions, as Mel said. And you need to report it consistently as well across the different functions using consistent templates and KPIs. But you need to be tracking those things so they're built into your routine. So if you've got normal audits and corrective actions and you're closing those out, you need to be also monitoring and updating that as well with your KPIs. So I think for your risk register and risk categories, you should be doing it monthly. But you need to make sure you're feeding all this information to the same reporting. So when you do another audit on a supplier, when you're doing audits of your plants, third-party audits, consumer complaints, COVID happens and it changes the landscape again. Or, you know, how are you continually updating your risk registers? Once you have that in place, I think it's easier to do. But you then need to, I'm talking about reporting up to the board level, so all these things collide at least for twice a year.
Okay.
So that's what I've seen and the best way of doing it, I've seen. I don't know if Mel's got any different comments.
You know, I think that would be the cadence I would describe as industry standard practice or bordering on best practice as well. My observation is that what I often see is that it's a risk assessment. We call it and refer to it as a risk assessment. But in some companies, what we're really doing is a hazard assessment. You know, we're looking at, oh, we have the hazard for Listeria to occur. Well, why? Here I go, being a five-year-old. Why? Well, I've got a visible weld that is, you know, there's a bunch of, you know, kind of crevices in this machine. And over the last 3 months, I've seen a 10% increase in environmental species or in Listeria species. On swabs, for example. Go back to your data, right? But also understand, when are you talking about hazards, like the hazard for Listeria, and then how are you going to translate that and calculate that to risk? Hazard is a potential something could cause harm. Risk is the likelihood and the impact, right? Risk is how is that relative to the rest of these enterprise risks we're, you know, punching it out for the finite pennies in the piggy bank for, right? So if you're, you know, if your data is showing you, you're seeing all of a sudden like another 10% uptick, and that's atypical and unusual, you can make a business case. You can turn some of this like back of the napkin math around to say, well, we know that our odds of getting inspected by FDA are once every 5 years. We know they have eyes. And so the chances of them seeing this, you know, this particular issue is probably 90%. And then the chance they're actually going to swab it's probably also 90%. Because if I would do it, why wouldn't they, right? The average cost of a recall is $10 million, according to the last macro level study that that has been published, for example. You can start to literally run some percentages and numbers to say, okay, net annualized loss to me, we're looking at a risk of a $450,000 a year recall, you know, or we could invest $30,000 to replace the machine or the part. How do you turn hazard to risk, step one, and risk to reward, step two? That's the top down, bottom up approach we're really talking about. And the rest of this slide is just steps or tips or criteria that you can use to leverage that. But if you can turn, as a food safety professional, hazard into risk, hazard listeria, risk into number of dollars, because that's typically the risk language most CFOs and COOs hear and understand. And then how do we turn that into a reward for the organization? Best yet, hey, we replace that part or that piece of equipment, and our production volumes can increase by 200 units an hour. If you can start working with, again, going back to Neil's comment, that multidisciplinary approach, that multifunctional team, you know, go to your ops guys and gals and your production guys and gals, go to demand planning and go try to get some help with the numbers to build your business case to say, you know, and the icing on the cake is we can make even more safe product, sell more money, right? Then the risk of the cost associated with mitigating the hazard is seen as even lower. Hopefully that's not as confusing as it might sound at first blush, but that's the ultimate play here.
The bit I take from what you just said, Mel, is the risk and the hazard into a dollar value, that's the real kicker. That's the one that's going to get attention, because that either you're going to mitigate that or it's going to cost that if you don't take some action. And that's the one that always worked for me. If you can come up with a dollar value about this recall has cost X, or if we do this, we'll avoid Y. Then that's, you have to get to the, it's not always natural for us technical people to go there, but that's the right approach, honestly. You have to get to the number, and you have to talk in the clear, simple language, particularly on that influence one, for the C-suite leadership. You know, let's be brutally frank here. The more senior you go in an organization, the more plates they're juggling, the more things they're seeing. And that's why you get back to that old elevator speech. You've got 1 minute to convince me. You've got to come up with something really simple and clear,
right,
that I can understand. And the one way at that level is it has to be around money and dollars. And by spending X, you're going to avoid Y. And that's how you'll get the incentive and value from the senior leadership to mitigate those issues. Because I really do believe, and Mel's got me on a rant now almost, this is part of the problem though, Paul. It's not that CEOs and C-suite don't want to fix the issues, it's they've got competing priorities and they don't understand, and they don't really generally know how big a risk they're avoiding or getting away with by the skin of their teeth or seat of their pants.
Because we
don't make it clear and simple enough. That's the problem. We don't intentionally hide, but we lose them with the technical jargon.
Right.
And I think, Neil, to your point, it is not that the CFOs and the CEOs and the COOs don't want to do the right thing and invest in food safety. It's just that it's easier to invest in some of these other risks because they have more data. They have quantifiable monetary currency risk, number one. And number two, like, you can just Google what are the chances of a cybersecurity ransomware attack in the United States. And you can find peer-reviewed information that someone in your IT department is walking into the boardroom with going, see, here's the risk. Here's somewhere we can point to. In food safety, we don't talk about the real risk of salmonella. Come on, any of you listening here that work in a food company, how many times have you known that there was, you know, a pathogen positive, but you caught it in time and you reported it nowhere, so it doesn't go into anything publicly available? And we don't have the data as food safety professionals to walk in and go, here's your risk. It's X. It's this percent. It's this much money. Whereas a lot of these other enterprise risks have lots and lots and lots of peer-reviewed studies they can go to say, bingo, here's how, because the next question of the CEO is, here's a hazard, it's gonna cost you X, here's the investment to avoid it. They're gonna say, but what's the likelihood? Because that's what risk is, right? It's likelihood and impact. Where do you go to get the information about likelihood and impact? Some of these other enterprise risks have a better fight because they've got better data than we do.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing as well is because technical functions generally do everything they can to manage and mitigate, in some cases with limited resources, the organizations tend to trust those people to manage the issues and keep us out of jail and make sure that there's no recall and no one gets sick.
Right.
So because of that, you're a victim of your own success in a way, because you're managing and making do and doing everything with a band-aid to stop it happening. So there's a sense of trust in a way, and no one wants to see anything go wrong. But by the fact that you keep doing that, you're actually, you know, contributing to the problem. So if you don't clearly communicate what the risks are and the future risks, and this is a concern, then you're really not helping yourself overall.
This was amazing. I appreciate it. So we touched on a whole bunch of things here right now, but you know, we're talking about reporting internally in the organization. We're looking at how risks are monitored. Maybe I'll just start with you, Neil. Have you seen, you know, a lot of companies need to ensure their objectives are strategic and well-defined? That's obvious from what I just heard. Do you know, is there a best practice out there right now for that?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that people know me well will always say, don't give me anything more than one page, because, you know, that's, if it's more complicated than one page, forget it. So everything from the organization I was in, from top to bottom of the company, should be there. So for the quality, food safety, technical objectives, if you can't get it on one page with the strategy, the goal, the measures and the risks and everything, the OGSAM approach, where it's all together in simple right. language, where everyone can follow it, then you've lost it already. Because you have to be able to do that for a huge organization or a small one. And if you're just filling up KPIs and targets and goals and objectives just to fill a book or a 10-slide PowerPoint, then it's a failure already. So simple, concise, clear, and it's then back to the culture and the whole organization. That should be translated down from whoever, the most senior food safety quality person, to everybody in the organization, and it should be really clear, it should be well understood, and it should be visible and available. And, you know, can't say it's best practice, but from my experience, we used to do that, publish that, and cascade it down. And everyone that then, basically my team and below, would write objectives against that one pager. So that everything should be contributing to, if there's an issue around recalls, or there's how to drive improve monitoring or whatever it is, or improve data reporting. Everything should tie back to what are the goals for the organization. And it basically goes back down to an ERM, because everything in technical should be around mitigating, monitoring, or managing risk.
Right. And I, you know, love the fact that, you know, the best practice is to keep it to one page. Of course, now I'm going to have to go and rewrite all of my business plans and strategies, but I like where you're going with that.
Who reads them, Paul? It's all on a page. Who's reading
them? I've often been accused of providing too much information on more than one occasion, Neil.
I can tell you a current company I've been working with, they have a challenge with some of the people maybe in the organization, a people thing where there's a disconnect between the senior leadership and the operational people.
Right.
And part of that is the lead person is creating 45-page slides of blah, 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 and no content. And it's not that he doesn't mean well, he does, but the detail is then losing its way with the management above, and they can't understand what the hell he's talking about.
Right. Yeah, no, that's great. You know, Mel, I want to talk about this point a little bit because I've spoken about this a few times already this year, and in fact, pretty recently with Peter Begg from her side a few weeks ago on this. But and you even both talked about it today. Many food safety professionals are competing in their organizations for resources, both financial and otherwise. So from your standpoint, how does leveraging some of the ERM principles you've talked about today help them?
Well, I think, a lot of these tips we've talked about levels the playing field, right? And it empowers us to understand that, hey, we're leading a business unit just like anyone else is, and that's predicated on numbers. And if we can translate that hazard to a monetary dollar risk, whether it's risk avoidance or whether it's, risk acceptance, or they're going to transfer the risk. So here's what you can do with risk. You can accept it, you can avoid it, you can reduce it, and you can transfer it. It's about the options. Mm-hmm. Some companies will go through a risk assessment and realize, you know what, the risk of being in a particular industry sector product might be too high for us. So maybe we're going to, instead of continuing to try to do it ourselves, maybe we're going to go to a co-manufacturer. And transfer some of that risk. It's not completely gone. We're not avoiding it because it's still our brand. It's still our product. Someone else who does this day in and day out and better understands the risk and knows how to mitigate the risk associated with it may be better suited. So I think those are some important, key points, is that these are all tools. These are all resources. And Neil, when you were talking, it really kind of punched me between the eyes for the first time. Is like, so whether we're talking about enterprise risk management, we're talking about the shop floor day-to-day daily metrics that we keep in food safety, looking at enterprise risk management in of itself, all of these should make sure that there is a connection, that there's a baton handoff. They're all leading in the same direction, pointed at the same North Star, which should be your corporate strategic plan, yeah. Right? And so if we don't start with what's the plan? How are we growing? Where are we growing? Are we growing organically? Are we growing by acquisition, a combination of both? Are we growing in the US market? Are we going to expand internationally? All of that really is that ultimate umbrella under which maybe the ERM umbrella comes next, under which all of these other enterprise risk programs, like your cybersecurity program and your food safety program, and your sales and marketing program, all fall under that umbrella. But they should all stack and they should all be pointing the same direction, because otherwise we're going to get into a hell of a crash in our organizations, and perhaps that alone becomes an enterprise risk, because that alone, our intra company kind of competition could do us in. Exactly.
The other one I just wanted to mention as well, Paul and Mel, is I'm a real big believer, apart from the simple one pager on objectives and goals and strategy and everything connecting, is 3 to 5 things, never more than 5 things. Give me more than 5 things, no one's going to remember anything that you've said.
Right.
But never 4. Neil does not do
never 4. 3 or 5.
it's just an odd number. But it's like 5 is the maximum things that people are going to remember. And also back to what Mel was just saying. If I'm tracking and monitoring something, why am I doing it? And this is back to the 5 whys again. I've always done it like that. We've always tracked this. We've always inspected like this. We've always tested that on the supplier. Why? Because you've got to look at it and say, what are we doing this for, and how is this mitigating the risk, and how is this improving the overall revenue and growth of the company? They have to connect. Right. They have to connect.
Oh, that's great. Before we get to the audience Q&A, I have one more question for each of you. I'm going to start with you here, Neil. How does a company know if leveraging the ERM is working? And the second part to that is, what other recommendations do you have for ensuring food safety is actually seen as an enterprise risk?
Well, how is it working? I guess if people start asking the right questions, so especially if you're reporting the information to the board, as we did at Coke as well, people are asked the questions on a routine basis. And even we used to have to prepare the report for the audit committee before the board meeting so that those risks are connected and reviewed. So you're mitigating risks over, 200 countries and 1,000 plants and the suppliers and all the issues.
Right.
And hopefully, if there have been any recalls, there's questions asked. And that visibility of data and, the internet and the wider communication now of everything means that, the whole story, nothing can be hidden anymore. And as greater transparency continues, you can't hide things and bury it. Something happened in Poland and no one will find out about it in North Dakota. They probably know like 2 minutes later.
Right. Yeah.
It's impossible to stop that happening anymore. So that's an even bigger reason to make sure you're clear on your communication and your risks are identified and you're communicating up to the board level, because your CEO could get sidestopped at any point and ask for an interview and a comment. That's what used to happen for us. So you have to be clear. You have to make sure the right people are briefed and aware. That's another one of my sayings. You need to see around corners to know what's happening before it's happened. That's obviously impossible to do, but that's the ideal scenario. So you have to connect and use that ERM framework.
Great. Thank you, Neil. And Mel, food fraud is still obviously very prevalent today. That more than any, being a lawyer. If we're looking at this from an ERM lens, how would you think that internal and external forces today that companies are subjected to impact their overall risk profile?
Well, truly, I think food fraud regained some notoriety, for lack of a better word, or attention during COVID. Right. When we had a lot of these supply chain disruptions, right? And so leveraging a model like ERM really should have purposefully stumbled you into reevaluating risks around your supply chain, right? What's happening? Where are the supply chains in our organization? Where are the disruptions happening? What is the likelihood and the impact? What's the risk associated, with, the Suez Canal backed up for a month, and what's on, what's backed up? What's the risk that our suppliers are going to be changing production facility locations, even though their contract says they're not supposed to? What are the risk of all of these things, right? How do we know that our partners, whether it be we're talking about food fraud, food safety, just general supply chain management, are doing what they say they're doing? It's by implementing some sort of a periodic and ongoing monitoring process to be able to measure that compliance against. I know it sounds easier said than done. It probably is easier said than done, but make an attempt, because if you ask someone to behave in a certain manner and you don't monitor and impart consequences when they don't, no one will listen. It's not worth the paper it's written on, right? And so you're almost in a worse spot because you've identified a risk to your organization. It could be a potential legal risk or a reputational risk, operational risk, regulatory risk. You call it out, you require compliance to a certain set of behaviors. And then when those behaviors don't happen, either because you don't know, because you're not watching, or you do see it, and it's the, well, we've been doing business with them for 20 years, or that's the only place I can get it, and so no consequences happen, you're in a worse potential exposure as an enterprise from a potential liability because you knew the risk and you didn't do anything about it. So I think things even like food fraud really come back full circle in that analysis of, if we know that on a good day in a non-pandemic time frame, we've got a risk of economically motivated adulteration because we sell olive oil or seafood or some of these other, honey, some of these other products that are more highly susceptible to this risk. Well, are we doing anything different? How are we? Are we heightening our monitoring? Are we heightening our mitigation measures? Are we holding people accountable when they're not complying with our requirements? Or are we just letting everything slide through, right? Because then ultimately that very likely could generate what an enterprise risk is, which is a risk to, it's a material risk to the survival of your company. It could take you down. And food fraud is no exception there.
All right, thank you. You know, at the beginning of the hour, I said it was an honor to be part of this today, and I meant it. It's always a pleasure to spend time with you, Neil and Mel. And I, again, on behalf of our company, thank you very much. So at this point, I'm going to pass it over to Amy, who will lead us through our audience Q&A. Thank you again.
Absolutely. It is that time. I'm just opening up the question panel here. Get those questions in. We'd love to answer them. We might go over by a few minutes, but I think we've got a couple to spare here. Let me pull up the first question. And either of you, you know, chime in if you have thoughts on this. None of these that I have so far are directed at anyone specifically. So that is fine if you just want to jump in. This one is from Ashley. Ashley is wondering, you know, what metrics are most useful for the M stage of the matrix? And let me, since we're talking about that slide, let me go back really quick for the monitor, mitigate, and measure step.
Neil is not jumping in, so I will. Sorry. When it's not directed at either one of us, we have these long pauses between us. Ashley, that's a really great question, and I think it goes in large measure back to the concept of risk, the risk appetite of your company. But ultimately, what is the definition of food safety and success in food safety at that top enterprise level, and then making sure that the metrics flow down. So almost that top down boardroom to shop floor approach, right? Are you monitoring for the same things the boardroom is concerned about? I think one of the first things we do with our clients who want to take on a project of integrating food safety with enterprise risk management is, let's lay out all the great data you're capturing now. Let's look at all of the metrics from shop floor all the way up to the boardroom. And then we basically go in and try to poke holes at that to see if there are any gaps, and if so, where they're at, and either identify another metric that needs to be kept in order to address that gap, right? And or go back to the five whys, five-year-old questions of, why are we concerned about that in the first place? Why are we capturing that information in the first place? So step one really is a health check, a gap assessment, a kick the tires at your current metrics to say, do they matter all the way up and all the way back down in the organization? Do ultimately the keeping of those metrics point us in that North Star direction to fulfill our strategic plan, our enterprise risk management process, and our food safety goals and objectives? Yeah, probably a little higher level than you were looking for, Ashley, but Neil, any other thoughts?
Well, just building on a little bit what you said, Mel. I mean, you know, it could be the lab data, it could be product test data, it could be the supplier audit results, it could be audit information, consumer complaints. But what Mel was just saying then is also important to say, of all that data you're collecting, which bits are going up, which bits are you then escalating up to the next level, and then which ones are you going to include in your risk framework, because you won't capture everything into your framework. So what are the most critical? So the first bit, I guess, is deciding out of all the data that you're monitoring and results that you're monitoring and audit information, which are the critical ones that should go up? Either they're not being monitored and mitigated correctly because they're creating a risk, or they're the most critical that if you didn't have people or resources against it, that would be a catastrophe. So I think it's looking what data you're currently capturing and which are the critical risks.
All right, thank you guys so much for that. Let's see, we've got a question now here from Jerry, and this one is an interesting one to me. Are there any recent or prominent examples of C-suites ignoring food safety that you can point out as an example of where ERM has failed?
I mean, but ERM has failed, but I guess you can go to the usual line, like the PCA, where the issues weren't communicated upwards. And I'm sure you can find plenty of examples if you Google food safety recalls, even maybe the Chipotle one, you know, where they've had to bring in other people, but not to name brands or anything specifically. There's plenty of examples. And I'm sure Mel can add as well. No one's intentionally, well, maybe not, I can't even say that. No one normally intentionally tries to do the wrong thing. It's usually a catalogue of issues or connected problems that contribute to the overall catastrophe. I don't think people are generally trying, in the food industry, are trying to do the wrong thing. It's just a question of when the wrong things and the wrong contributory events happen, then that's when you get a problem.
Yeah, I would agree. And I'd also go back to, you know, the topic we were just talking about, food fraud. A lot of our discussion around food fraud management is that, again, we don't hear a lot about those things, because if it's caught internally, it's typically kept close to the vest, right? No one's taking out one page ad campaigns going, hey, we caught the fact that, you know, we received horse meat and it slipped by us, and it wasn't until the very, like, right before it shipped out the door that, you know, we realized it. That stuff typically isn't reported. And so, really astute question, really probably hard to definitively answer that, a failure question, than it is to look to some anecdotal information, such as, well, every time there's a recall, we can probably assume somewhere in the process something broke down.
And that's going back to what I was saying about trying to see around corners and using horizon scanning and information to be predictive. Because the point Mel just made about if there's been a recall, if you look back and track it back, you usually find there's a set of events that have happened. It won't be just one thing.
Absolutely. All right, I've got one last question here. I know we've gone a little bit over the allotted time, but this last question is from Lewis, and very timely, of course. Have there been any notable shifts in how companies have handled ERM due to COVID?
Well, definitely. I think that's made everyone rethink everything, particularly, as Mel mentioned earlier, around operational risks for customers, visitors to site, and the health and safety of employees, particularly for people in food service. You know, at the beginning of the whole pandemic, we had loads of questions from customers about, are your products safe? Are surfaces safe? Can things be transmitted? So I think COVID has made people look at all their processes around risk management, and also, you know, the technical processes, because even down to sourcing, who knows where that'll end with local and global sourcing that a lot of companies have gone into. But I think it has made people reassess the risk management.
I think COVID really introduced the not just the concept of ERM, but the practice of it on a very frequent cadence during particularly the peaks and the waves of this pandemic for every organization, because people safety impacts every single department. You know, that's when you're on the even playing field, right? With cybersecurity and sales and marketing and you know, commodity pricing and currency exchange rate. Like, it's kind of that equal footing, right? But organizations really were forced to ask the question of how does this risk impact the survivability of our organization? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what ERM is what are all of the risks I'm dealing with, which ones relative to the others do I need to keep my eye a little bit more on, because the impact is greater, and we could lose people could die, the list of the ramifications goes on. But ultimately COVID really asked every organization to do an enterprise risk management process to look at all risks, I think, a lot more often.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you both again so much for taking the time out of your schedules to come and talk to us and answer all of these questions. I just wanted to, on behalf of Peter FSI, you know, offer our thanks, and hopefully we'll have you back again in the future for another webinar. I just want to quickly, for the rest of our audience who are still around, quickly touch on two upcoming webinars we have. As of with all of our webinars, they are free to register. You can find a full list of those and all the details, as well as the link to register, at our website. Along with on our website, we'll also have the slides from today's presentation, and the recording from today will be posted to our YouTube channel, and that usually goes up within 24 to 48 hours of the broadcast. So Neil, Mel, Paul, thank you all so much for taking the time today. It's great to have everyone on and get some good dialogue going. And we hope to see everyone on the next webinar. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.